You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Hello, good evening. Welcome. I am Maureen Moore, the Associate Director of Aloud of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. So for tonight, I feel that we're probably all muttering, myself included, the last part of Anne Lamott's prayer, the thanks and wow part. Thanks for the opportunity to listen to two amazing, brilliant voices, and wow, they're both on the same stage at the same time. Through the humility of her prose, Anne Lamott connects to her readers through the solace of her words, the wisdom of her advice, and a transparency of spirit that lets the reader in, forging a kinship between writer and reader. She illuminates our humanity through candor and humor by finding sublime within the mundane. Through her own journey, she helps us to remember how to surrender, to be open to grace, and how to make room for gratitude. I can't think of a more appropriate voice to complement hers than our own Father Gregory Boyle, a man whose love and compassion is doled out with a no-matter-whatness. His life's work shines light on the humanity in all of us, giving chances to the voices that have been silenced or led astray. If there is anything that unites these two remarkable individuals, it is belief in the power of transformation and the power of grace. Anne Lamott is author of 7 novels and 7 works of nonfiction, among them the New York Times bestsellers, Some Assembly Required, Grace, Eventually, Plan B, Traveling Mercies, and Operating Instructions. She's a past recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and an inductee to the California Hall of Fame. Beyond the written word, Lamott exercises her voice as a progressive political activist, speaker, and writing teacher. Born into a family who revered books, reading became part of her world at a young age, and something she holds as sacred. To her, she says, quote, "Books are medicine." Leading Anne in conversation tonight is Father Gregory Boyle, an Angelino Jesuit priest and founder and executive director of Homeboy Industries, the local nonprofit organization which serves at-risk and gang youth through intervention and reentry programs. Homeboy Industries is recognized as a national and international model for youth seeking to move beyond gangs and to achieve a life of hope. Father Boyle's best-selling memoir, Tattoos on the Heart, was honored by Penn USA as the 2011 Best Creative Nonfiction Book of the Year. I've covered the last two parts of the prayer already, and now it's time for the first. So please help. Give our speakers a warm welcome. Father Gregory Boyle and Anne Lamott.
Thank you. Is this mic still working? It fell out of my pocket. Put it back. Okay, now I have to make sure all my people are here. Terry, are you here? Terry R. Steve, okay, Steve A. Oh, hi, Steve. Kevin B. Oh, hi, Kevin. And, Glenn L. Okay, good, we can begin. a situation. Need a priest. Thank you. That is the power of the Lord. You have just seen it. Okay, so I'm just going to read you a few pages from this book, and then we're going to just talk and invite you into questions and answers. But I just want to read a few pages. And first of all, it calms me. And second of all, so you know why I'm even traveling. Tomorrow I'm going to Minnesota where it's 20 degrees, which I'm completely confused and bitter about. Okay, this is the prelude called Prayer 101. I do not know much about God and prayer, but I've come to believe over the past 25 years that there's something to be said about keeping prayer simple. Help, thanks, wow. You may, in fact, be wondering what I even mean when I use the word prayer. It's certainly not what TV Christians mean. It's not for display purposes like plastic sushi or neon. Prayer is private even when we pray with others. It is communication from the heart to that which surpasses understanding. Let's say it is communication from one's heart to God. Or if that is too triggering or ludicrous a concept for you, to the good, the force that is beyond our comprehension, but that in our pain or supplication or relief, we don't need to define or have proof of or any established contact with. Let's say it's what the Greeks call the really real, what lies within us, beyond the scrim of our values, positions, convictions, and wounds. Or let's say it's a cry from deep within to life or love. Nothing could matter less than what we call this force. I know some ironic believers who call God Howard, as in Our Father who art in heaven, Howard be thy name. I called God Phil for a long time after a Mexican bracelet maker promised to write Phil 4:4-7 on my bracelet, Philippians 4:4-7 being my favorite passage of scripture, but he only got as far as Phil before having to dismantle his booth. Anyway, Phil is a great name for God. Let's not get bogged down on what or whom we pray to. Let's just say prayer is communication from our hearts to the great mystery or to goodness or Howard, to the animating energy of love we are sometimes bold enough to believe in, to something unimaginably big and not us. Some of you were taught to pray at bedtime with your parents, and when I spent the night at your houses, I heard all of you saying these terrifying words. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake. Wait, what? What did you say? I could die in my sleep. I'm 7. Help. Sometimes the first time we pray, we cry out in the deepest desperation, God help me. This is a great prayer, or as we are then at our absolutely most degraded and isolated, which means we are nice and juicy with the consequences of our best thinking and are thus possibly teachable. Or you might shout at the top of your lungs or whisper into your sleep, I hate you, God. And this is a prayer too, because it is the truth. And maybe it's the first sincere thought you've had in months. We can pray for things. Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? We can pray for people. Please heal Martin's cancer. Please help me not be such an asshat. We may pray for things that would destroy him if we got them. Teresa of Avila said, more tears are shed over answered prayers than unanswered ones. We can pray for a shot at having a life in which we are present and awake and paying attention and being kind to ourselves. We can pray, hello, is there anyone there? Prayer can be motion and stillness and energy all at the same time. It begins with stopping in our tracks or with our backs against the wall or when we are going under the waves or when we're just so sick and tired of being psychically sick and tired that we surrender. Or at least we finally stop running away and at long last walk or lurch or crawl towards something. Or maybe miraculously, and the hardest thing of all, we just release our grip slightly. Prayer is talking to something or anything with which we seek union, even if we are bitter or insane or broken. In fact, these are probably the best possible conditions under which to pray. Prayer is taking a chance that against all odds and past history, we are loved and chosen and do not have to get it together before we show up. The opposite may in fact be true. We may not be able to get it together until we show up in such miserable shape. Prayers are sometimes real selves, trying to communicate with the real, with truth, with the light. It is us reaching out to be heard, hoping to be found by a light and warmth in the world instead of dark and cold. Even mushrooms respond to light. I suppose they blink their mushroomy little eyes like the rest of us do. Light reveals us to ourselves, which is not always so great if you find yourself in a big, disgusting mess, probably of your own creation. But like sunflowers, we turn toward light. Light warms us, and in most cases, it draws us to itself. And in this light, we can see beyond shadow and illusion to something beyond our modest receptors, to what is way beyond us and deep inside. This is all hard to articulate because it is so real, so huge, beyond mystery. Rumi said that all words are fingers pointing to the moon, and we think the words are the moon. But because of the light of love, the energy and motion that have called us to prayer, bits of this deeper reality are perceivable, and little bits of it will just have to do. My three prayers are variations on help, thanks, wow. That's all I ever need, besides the silence, the pain, and the pause, sufficient for me to stop, close my eyes, and turn inward. So I think I'll stop there.
This conversation and wait for my microphone to kick in. And then, about 40 minutes, I guess, we'll open it up to the audience. I'm such a fan, first of all. I've read everything you've ever written, including essays. And so I'm having this, I have this recurring nightmare where I'm interviewing Anne Lamott on the stage at the LA Public Library. This is a step up. I'm fully clothed, so it's you saw all my lines and stuff that I love, and so it made me go back to Philippians, mm-hmm. like why that is something that you like. You know, it's about rejoice in the Lord always. Do not be anxious ever. And then it's about...
Let everybody see your kindness.
Yeah, may everybody see how gentle and understanding your heart is, you know? Mm-hmm. So talk about that a little bit. How did that...
My pastor, Veronica, has always given it to people, including her kids, as sort of an emergency all-purpose prayer. So sometimes I don't even ask her what to do anymore because I know she's going to direct me towards... She'll listen, but I know she's secretly just trying to shoehorn in that line of scripture. And it's just, it's three sentences or four.
Yeah.
And it's everything I have to remember, but which is so easily forgotten, that things are really okay.
Yeah.
And that there really is the peace of God within us in the heart cave. And together, two of us sitting together in the back room like we were, can find perfect peace and fullness that the world really doesn't have to offer. And it just says... It's really going to be okay. Just stay very, very close to God as you understand God.
Yeah.
Stay really close. Let people see your kindness. If you want to feel fantastic and filled up and generous as a result of that, then you just get everybody water and you share what you have. And I had a discussion with God the other day about whether sharing everything I have included the salted caramels that I was trying to keep from my son, Sam. And I heard from God that no, it did not include the salted caramels. But let everybody see your kindness. If you don't know what to do, if you're acting like a jerk or a spoiled brat like I might be or whatever, go to the health food store and flirt with the old people. You know, get people water. Sit down with people for a minute and just sit with people for 5 minutes. You're going to get happy.
Yeah.
So that's why I love that scripture because it's four sentences. It's all I have to remember.
And then you have sort of a mantra. I was using it today. It wasn't fully successful in my day. But the thing about pay attention and just don't be a jerk, you know.
Yeah.
And how do you focus? How do you bring focus to that as a, or like paying attention? What tricks do you have to kind of?
I'll tell you one great trick I have is that when my older brother John quit smoking 28 years ago, he went to a place and they gave them just plain old rubber bands, because when you start tripping out on a craving, the craving says the only way out of this pain and obsession is a few puffs of a cigarette. But if you snap this rubber band very gently, not like they might have in our childhood, but gently, just a gentle snap, it's like being spritzed by a plant mister, and you kind of go, because the craving's going to pass in a few minutes. It doesn't tell you that. The voice of the devil is sweet to hear. It's going to tell you, I'm the one that's going to stick by you, me and the cigarettes. And but if you snap it, you kind of go, it startles you like a baby being startled, and it brings you back to the present. And I actually, if you look at me, about a third of the time I have a little rubber band on, because left to my own devices, it's just this ticker tape of thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It triggers something for me about recovery, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I read an interview where you thought that like AA had sort of taught people millions of people how to pray, and that like
well,
Richard,
I wouldn't know anything about that.
Yeah.
But
the singular? Because I think it's what like probably you know, maybe we're not supposed to talk about that, but the about it's such a huge singular contribution to
the 12-step recovery
to
program,
American
yeah.
spirituality.
Yeah, huge.
It's kind of it, you know.
Huge.
And,
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
I think it's just the most amazing, radical, new idea that had come along in a couple hundred years of American history, that it was going to be people, one person talking to another, one wounded person talking to another person who got it, who didn't say, but why would you keep doing that, knowing what the result? Why? I don't understand why you would continue to do that. And people go, oh, yeah, me too. But see, for me, Jesus is the big me too. It's like you say, I hate it here. It's been a bad match for me. It's never felt like my home. People are so scary and cruel, and I don't understand a thing. And she's like, yeah, you know, me too. I get it.
Yeah.
I get the cruelty. I get the deprivation. I get the destitution in which most people live. And so with the 12-step people that I've known, it's all about God as one understands God. It's nothing being shoved down your throat. And it's understanding that no one in history has ever gotten anyone well. You know, that only the consequences of the person's catastrophic decisions and God, as each person might dare to think of a God, could help that person. But there's a lot of us around with the water, with a, you know, an empty chair that we're happy to plop down into for half hour or whatever.
Yeah. The I was in the book a couple times. You talk with some dread about it's kind of praying and wanting God to somehow no more deaths. For example, was something
yes.
you said.
Yes. But, if I were God's West Coast representative, no more deaths in my family personally. I feel that I have paid, and I don't think that's
unreasonable. But how does your spirituality help you with that? How do you get to a place where, you know, I was reading a profile on the Dalai Lama, and the reporter asked him about his own personal death, and he goes, change of clothing, he says.
That's how I feel. Change and, of address.
Yeah. How does the spirituality lend itself so that you don't be toppled by the thought of it or the fact of it?
God, you know, I think it's partly having been a sober person for a long time, because I know where I was in 1985, the year before I got sober, and that's actually when I found my church and Christ. But so then I had the kind of gap year till I got sober in mid-86. But there's no explanation for why I am one of the people that got to stay alive, except grace, except some sort of fluky and divine assistance. And so, you know, Raymond Carver wrote he was just a terrible, terrible drunk, as you know.
Yeah.
And he wrote a poem, the second to last poem he wrote in the New Yorker was called Gravy. And it said, I have known the gutter. I have known what it's like to wake up sick and in just the most degraded, confused state. And he said, I've been sober 10 years and I'm in love with a wonderful woman and everything has just been gravy. Because he got grace. He got fished out and set on his feet and became a person of kindness and purpose. And that's how I feel. I feel like it has all been gravy. I would prefer not to die soon, and I prefer not to die badly. But I feel like God is like so not interested in my thoughts on how we and everybody else should proceed. And so I've been flying around the country, and I saw Flight twice.
Oh, no.
Yeah. In one week. The second time was an accident. But
not on a plane.
No, but then yeah. I got on a plane, and I've been to about 15 places, so I keep looking to see if the pilot's drunk or tweaking. I just don't feel afraid of God. I so believe in an eternity. I so believe that this is one side of eternity, and it really has not been a good match. But the love, the humanity, the resurrection stories that I have been honored to either be a part of or to witness or to find out about, like your guys and your women, it convinces me that Einstein was right, that it can't be destroyed, that energy can't be destroyed, and that I think there's a lot more going on the border of the movie screen. Like, I can just see the screen right now, but I think there's a lot more going around the 6 inches on all four sides. And this side of the grave, I don't think I'm going to get to know a lot more about what's going on. So I feel with certain hard cases, God lets me keep things very simple. I get thirsty people water. I ask if people need someone to talk to. And I try to help other women get sober, stay sober. And I also, the hardest thing, I keep it very simple. Help, thanks, wow. But I love that line of William Blake's, that we're here to learn to endure the beams of love, yeah. You know, and it's just so awful to learn to endure the beams of love. It's the hardest work I do, but all these people in recovery and in my church have convinced me that love is not from this side, not from this earth, and it makes me believe that there is another side where things do make sense and where there is union again with what was true and eternal about all of us all along, whether we had lives of 5 years or 95 years. So I just don't sweat it that much. But of course, if you bring up the death of somebody else that I can't live without, I feel, please, just do this one thing for me, God. I swear this time I mean it. I will be so different in every way. But I'm not afraid of my own death. I'm 58. It's a little late for it to seem tragic, you know?
Yeah. Even theologically, there was a kind of a debate going on of this pastor who was sort of, I don't remember what his name was. It was in the New Yorker, where he's kind of in the evangelical movement, kind of because he doubts the presence of hell.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, right.
And
Rob
so
Bell.
Rob Bell, and it had Timothy Keller, who I like, you know, mm-hmm. who is a New York pastor and writer, and he's sort of countering his take in mm-hmm. saying, no, God has to be wrathful, that God has to have the capacity and does in fact judge and rejects those who have rejected him. And it seemed like a kind of I just don't get it. I mean, we can conjure up the names of holy people who are good and kind and generous and open, and you couldn't imagine them wrathful, and you couldn't imagine them rejecting somebody who had rejected them. So is the suggestion that somehow God is less than the holiest person you know? It doesn't make sense to me.
It makes no sense to me, but I don't have literally I don't have a single interesting theological thought. I understand nothing. My relationship with Jesus is like me and Casper the Friendly Ghost. You know, it is so uninteresting and dumb. And I can't debate with anyone. But to me, it seems like there's a zero chance that there's a hell. It is impossible for me to believe that the wrathful side of God, but I sure believe in the wrathful side of the damaged, wounded, revengeful side of people that come up with what they believe God meant when he said this or that, but I don't believe in it. And, you know, when I'm in the South, if I'm on a radio show, people call, and they also have very sweet accents. You know, they say, well, Miss Lamott, I guess if you are in favor of homosexual love, that you will rot in hell for all eternity. And it's hard for me to believe that that woman might speak for God, you know, and that I'm banking on two things, that God is love and that God has a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I am doomed. I'm beyond doomed.
I was reading an interview, I think it was one of those 10-question things, you know, for Time magazine, where you thought this was, I mean, this felt more vulnerable, the material, than, say, Plan B or maybe some other thing. Well, say more about that. Why was this?
I think it's vulnerable only because it's embarrassing to be a Christian in the modern era. Because if you're a believer or you're in recovery or you have a very non-specific sense of God, it kind of doesn't make a lot of sense, like the whole Jesus thing. I mean, no offense to your people, but, you know, it's like the space traveler comes down and then he's crucified on a cross, and because of that, all of our sin is lifted. But I live by it. I believe it, but it makes no sense. So when normal people, like not Christians, hear the word Christian, who do you think of? You think of Sarah Palin, right?
Yeah.
You think of Mike Huckabee. You are going to be tested in fire. And if you voted for Obama, you are going to go to hell. Thank you, Mike Huckabee, who I want to point out has gained back most of the weight. I think that it's bizarre. I mean, before I was a Christian, I just found it kind of delusional. I always believed in God, and all through my 20s, I tried to find a place for me, but it couldn't be Christian. You had to draw the line, you know, somewhere. You have to have standards no matter how low. And I thought, my father hated Christians because he was raised by Presbyterian missionaries. So I was raised not to be a Christian, and my dad had been dead, but, you know, they never die, right? I just felt like I don't want to be a Christian. All my friends are left-wing intellectuals, I swear it was an accident. You have to believe me, that I ended up at this garage, at this flea market in Marin City, which is a very impoverished and mostly black and Asian part of Marin County, and I ended up there because when I'm hungover, I love greasy food. Now, I haven't had a drink in a long time, but I remember when I'm hungover, I love flea market food. And I saw this crummy little church with this horrible little tree out in front, like the tree in Waiting for Godot, you know. It has two leaves in the first act, and then in the second act it has three. And this is what redemption and grace are available. But it's a miracle. I mean, there's three leaves all of a sudden, right? So, and I went in because I'd run out of good ideas. I was at the end of my rope. I was scared to death. I had had three books out already. I live in the same county where I was born and raised. I'm loved beyond all sense of proportion. Every relative I have lives there. And yet I was Swiss cheese. I was, I don't have depression. I'm a tiny bit more worried than the average bear, but I don't have clinical depression, and yet I was at that place. And so I went into this crummy little church, and there were still about 30 people there. There's still about 30 people there. And my son always says, there's not 30 people there. He says 25, because if he goes, he counts. But it's a failing little church. It's always been a failing little church. And they didn't hassle me. They didn't say, well, do you believe? Which I didn't. And I believed in God, but not Jesus. And they didn't say, well, would you be willing to study the Bible? No, I would have run.
Yeah.
They didn't say, do you know that you, are you willing to, or the worst thing of all, can we have a home visit? You know? And I would say to all ministers, the most destructive thing you can ever ask of a lost soul who walks into your sanctuary or narthex is, can we have a home visit? Because that, you are not going to see that person again. And they didn't say it to me. They just could see that I was a ruined person. And they just were so glad I was there. because the air was nutritious, because the love is medicine. And so I accidentally ended up, and I was drunk, luckily, and still drinking and using, and little by little I started to experience a physical manifestation of Jesus as this sort of little feral cat. And I'm not stupid. I know you don't stop to pet a little feral cat because suddenly it's your cat. Now your cat has a name and needs. And I wasn't well enough to have anything needing me, and I, except for the whole world, and because I'd been like flight attendant to the whole world since I was 3. So, but I couldn't take care of a cat, is what I'm saying. And I just felt Jesus around, and I just didn't want him. And finally I said, I was ground down. I said, I quit. Okay, fine, I said with enormous hostility. And I started staying around for the Jesus part, and 6 or 7 months later I got sober, and then I got baptized. But I still find it very embarrassing to be a Christian, because I certainly mean no offense. I don't want to turn this into an ugly political evening. But because of the far right in this country, you see Christians, you think Quran burners. You think people that hate every denomination but their own. Or as Tom Weston said, you know, you can tell God is you created God in your own image because he hates all the same people, coincidentally, that you do. And the Christian right in this country has destroyed the self-esteem of regular Christians who are feeding people, and they're gathering clothes, and they're having benefits, and they're having garage sales. They're not handling snakes, and they're not threatening homosexuals and liberals with eternal damnation. You know, and they're feeding people. And so I always thought, well, and I grew up loving Martin Luther King. He was a hero in our family, and so was John Kennedy. And I thought, that's who I want to be like when I grow up. And of course, he was out of control in certain areas of his life sexually. And, and he was like the purest person that I think has passed amongst us, and certainly in the last century. So I think it's kind of risky, because it's just so not the New York literary establishment, which is much more ironic than I am, and much, much better educated than I am. And so I thought, well, ha ha, I'll just let go of the results. Ha ha, I'll just do it and let go of the results. But I have to say also quickly, my publisher did not want Bird by Bird, which was sort of a similar book about writing. They said, oh, writers don't want that sort of, you know, distilled information. Like my pitch was, write badly, write a little every day, keep your butt in the chair, you'll be fine. You probably won't get published. If you were, you would be more mentally ill than you already are. You know, try to find someone who will help you. That will be grace. That will be communion. That will be worthwhile. And they didn't want it. They wanted a novel. I said, well, I really think I could do this little writing book. It's 93. I think it came out in 94. Well, we really think it would be best. And I had to talk them into it. They had to talk me into this one. But it's the same sort of concept. All we're talking about is that you can talk to God. I see him as Jesus. I don't know why that is. I felt him come into my room when I was drunk, and I felt him as surely as you're sitting there right now. And I turned to the wall, and I said, I'd rather die. And that's the truth. So it's not a beautiful conversion story, but it's mine.
Yeah. Well, how about when you were 5, when you had that secret where you said...
Well, if you haven't read the book, there's a story. I have my older brother, John, who's 60, who's a born again. But first, I was the laughing stock of my family for getting baptized at St. Andrew in 86. Way before he voted for George Bush in 2000. Because he became a born again, and my brother, we were raised by these raging progressive liberal ACLU. We were out at San Quentin as children protesting executions, you know. And my brother had this year, and he never did it again. And he voted for John Kerry and twice for Obama. But he'll say, and I adore him, and he'll still say things like, because he's a born again. I mean, no offense to the born again. He'll say, well, you know, Annie, do you really think humans are good for much besides sin? And because I have talked to the random person in Al-Anon, they have taught me to say, ah, huh, okay. So, I say that. But we were raised by these people not to believe. And we had this, but he told me the story, and I used it in the book. So touching to me. It just brought tears to my eyes. But we had a babysitter named Carol, and when my mom was pregnant with my younger brother, I was 5 and my older brother was 7, I came up to my brother while we were being babysat, and I said, I have to tell you a secret. We have to go to the top of the stairs by the attic. And he didn't like me that much. I kind of destroyed his life by being born. So it's been a bit of a struggle for me to believe I'm welcome here. But anyway, went with my brother to the top of the stairs by the attic door, and I said, I want to invite the baby Jesus into my heart. I need to invite the baby Jesus into my heart. And he was like, what the, but he said he could see how really desperate I felt about this. And I had him bow his head, and I asked baby Jesus into my heart. You know, and then 27 years later, I did again, but that story is so touching to me.
But he told you the story. You didn't remember.
He told me the story.
You didn't remember it.
But as soon as he told me, I remembered the name of the babysitter, and I remembered the babysitter's father's hands. Isn't that funny? Because I always, if you watch carefully, my fly is always down. I'm always lost. I leave my luggage at the TSA security thing, so I'm always arousing suspicion. And yet, I can remember the hands of a babysitter's father from 53 years ago. That's just, that mattered to me. Something mattered. So I don't know.
You say, I guess towards the end of the book, about the three essential truths, which we're all ruined.
We're so ruined.
We're so ruined, yeah. And so loved.
So loved.
And then the third one is...
And we're in control so
little.
Which I just hate. I just resent all three of those things, really.
But say more about the so ruined part.
Well, the people I've been close to have been people with whom I was able to identify and to share very freely because I knew, I trusted them not to say, but that was years ago, that was 50 years ago. I knew that they would say in some word or another, me too. I was scared to death as a child. I had this, I had migraines, I had OCD. I had to do the light switches 17 times before I could turn them off. If I heard any sound in the house, as a little child, as a 13-year-old, I had to go back to the switch. 1, 2, 3. Now, if I tell most people that, they get it. Even if they didn't have the exact wiring that I had, they get it. They were scared to death. They were holding their breath. They were felt that they had a little caseload with their parent, trying to keep their parents together, trying to help the brothers be okay, help not them use too much drugs, help mom not eat so much. I was 4, and I was trying to help dad come home. I was trying to get my mom to not eat so much, and for my brother not to hit me so much. People get this because their families were ruined too. Because I think most of us are. And I grew up finding ideal families. I thought the Catholic family, the Christian Science family. This is where I learned about scripture. This is when I learned about the brook, the stream, the voices in the stream of scripture, even when you don't understand it, that it cools you, that if you pay attention to it, it takes you someplace and you're not left where you were. And yet at the same time, these families were about suicides and alcoholism and divorce and the violence of the father against the mother. And those were the ideal families I found. So when I found families that were more like mine, they're all like, oh yeah, me too. And I have just come to believe that this is part of the human condition, is that that it's very hard here. It's very scary. I always thought if you were beautiful, if you looked a certain way or built a certain way, or you had a little bit of money, you were, not always worried financially, that you would feel full and centered. And you just kind of have good self-esteem. I don't know a soul who has consistently good self-esteem. I know people like me who have narcissistic personality disorder and terrible self-esteem, kind of alternating. And But I know how deeply we are loved. I know we are loved by the Mother, Father, Divine Creator. I know how much I love my child, and I'm a person of pretty screwed up person, you know, beautiful in a resurrection story and screwed up. I think it's the paradox that maybe the far right struggles with occasionally, that we can be all of these things all at once, and that we can accept our ruin, and that we can accept that all the poets that we love the most got it and expressed it for us. All the poets we love the most got that love that was at the center somehow of our experience here, that drew us to it, that healed unhealable wounds. And boy, do I know how little I'm in charge of. I mean, I've always heard or seen people say, oh, I'm in charge of everything on this side of my palm. You know, and that leaves a lot of space. Like, I went to India a few years ago, and I immediately thought, if I had a clipboard and some Post-its, I think I could really help these people get organized. I mean, and I thought, this is nuts. And I want to say, come on, people. I mean, no offense. This is crazy. The way you're living. Okay, everybody come here now. I'm going to need someone to take the socks commitment. Now, can I get a couple of, you know, that's what I think. Left to my own devices. Thank God I'm not left to my own devices. I feel that I'm in charge of almost nothing. I'm in charge of no one, that's for sure. I wasn't even in charge of my own kid. Can't even be, if you find out you're not even in charge of your own kid, that they're on their own hero's journey, that they not only are not that interested in your opinion, but that you annoy them, then how can, and it doesn't matter how much they love you, because it's all a paradox. It's all ruined in love. It's all we're responsible, and I'm a person of enormous discipline. I believe the discipline leads to freedom. I believe it's all just a paradox, and that my son adores me and I think would kill for me. And yet, my opinions annoy him sometimes. If I say something, he needs to resist it, you know? And he may say, okay, because he's met the same Al-Anon people. So he goes, he says, okay, Mom. Okay, Mom. But that's what I mean, is that I'm in charge really of the animals. You know, I have three animals and they shop poorly, you know. So I shop for them. And I take them for lots and lots of walks. And that seems to be mostly it. I show up, I'm a Sunday school teacher. I do lots of stuff. I do a lot of structured stuff. I write in the most structured possible way. I've never waited for inspiration. I don't believe in inspiration. And yet, don't see very many ways, except for the pets, that I'm in control.
How are things different? Like India reminded me of a wonderful book about Sam and Jax and your grandson.
Oh, thank you.
And so how is it different in terms of your relationship with your grandson?
Well, all the grandparents know, because it's so much easier to be a grandparent. Because, well, first of all, mine's 3.5, so he has not yet developed contempt for me. But he will. you know, it's like when you have little children, and they're just so lovely and innocent and full of wonder, and they adore you so desperately. Then they grow up, and they found the exact same ways to survive that you found. They start smoking dope. They start keeping secrets. They live for their friends. They only want to be in. Now they have email and texting. And Jax does not even have an iPhone yet. He has virtually no income. And he's just coming up into discovering anger. You know, he's 3.5, and some kids do it at 2.5. And my favorite thing he's ever said, although he's starting to grow out of it, is he just learned how powerful it is to be a little angry, how it really gets a grown-up's attention. And he'll say, oh, he makes this very scary mafia sound. He goes, oh, I just, oh, Nana, I'm so mad. It's just chilling. He'll do it like, the worst thing is people, we have a librarian friend who gives us a lot of books from the Fairfax Library, and children have crayon in them. And so Jack's got On Beyond Zebra, and on about page 10, someone had crayoned all over the boy Cornelius. But Jax would be into it because it's stimulating. It's kind of energetic. It's like a lot of us got into, you know, sex and love addiction and food addiction, dieting. People are gamblers, which is like the one thing I don't have. People are into shopping, which is another thing I don't have. But it's adrenaline. It's mood changing, right? It's mood altering. And so Jax will start turning the pages. He's okay. He's fine. Oh, and we're reading. And he gets to page 9. He's about to flip it over, and he flips it and goes, oh, Nana, I'm so mad. So we've all been going around for about 6 months going, I'm so mad. But it's just so much easier because they leave, right? And, Sam and Amy, his ex, share him almost equally. Sam probably has him 40% of the time. So he's in my house 40% of the time. And it's sort of ideal. It's perfect. And but, you know, your little ones, your innocent little Hallmark children with their bubbles chasing butterflies grow up. So I don't expect that it will always be this way. But I don't know that it changed my spirituality. I believed in taking children to church since I could, you know, had a child. I felt there's worse things you can do than to teach somebody to sit quietly for an hour, whether that was at a temple, whether that was in a zendo, to sit in community with wiser people, with the tribal elders, get out of yourself for an hour a week and hook into something bigger and wilder and sweeter. So I take Jax loves Sunday school because little ones love Sunday school because they're always in love with the teacher, Jill, and their colleagues, and the other three-year-olds. So I don't know that it's changed me. It's made me feel my vulnerability more. I thought having another a grandchild would mean it would be like in England when the princess always has an heir and a spare. But now I just feel like a total psychotic desperation that something will happen to Sam or to Jax, and that my life will come to an end, and then I'll hang myself. So that's my basic spiritual. That's the ground of my being.
And on that note, maybe we can open this up to, and they have some way where they're going to run around with microphones. And you can.
Yeah, and whatever you want to ask, if you want to ask Greg stuff about homeboys, how to contribute, homegirl bakeries, or you want to ask me about writing or ask him about writing, anything you want to ask, is we're really glad to share what we know.
Good evening. I started reading your book, and I was thinking about how you talked about help and think, and wow. And there's a part of me that says, you know, I want to say help, I don't want to be wounded. Help, I don't want to be vulnerable. But there's another part of me that says, I want to move on from help, I don't want to be wounded, to thank you because I am wounded, and thank you because I'm vulnerable. But I don't know how to move from one to another.
Well, for me, I'll just share what I know. It's a good question, is that the willingness always comes from the pain. It doesn't, you know, figure it out is not a good slogan. And I don't think you're going to figure anything out or break some sort of code in your mind. I never have. And I try, my default place is to try to figure things out. And, but I guess I've just been, since I was young, I think partly because I had migraines and partly because I was very, very bullied as a little child because of how I looked, I always knew I was wounded and ruined. And in fact, what recovery gave me was that everyone was, and that everybody else, that there's the old line that we keep comparing our insides to other people's outsides. But when you find a little core community where you get to tell the truth, our insides, yours and mine, are probably very similar. Shy and kind of held breath and, you know, human, so human, and that's so horrible. So I don't pray anymore not to be wounded because I just am. I pray help pretty regularly because I start to trip off into this thinking that it's all awful. Like during the election, I was really scared to death a lot, but I also believe you take the action and the insight will follow. So during the election, I raised money. I happened to have a gift for convincing people to give me money. In fact, I was trying to foist myself on Greg to be to do some sort of duet next year or something to try to raise money for Homeboy Industries, because for some reason people give me money. Be warned. Be warned. Do not give me money. Do not trust me with your pen. I take pens. But the thing is that you take the action, and the action is to talk to God differently and to say, maybe I am a little bit more damaged than I first thought. So I'm just praying to be able to breathe. It's like being in labor, you know, that help me breathe. Help me be where my butt or my shoes are. Help me, the hardest thing of all, help me pick up the 2,000-pound phone. Help me just talk to somebody else right now. Help me call one of my girlfriends. Help me take an action. You go outside, that's the wow, you know. 100% of the time, if you step, you might say wow because of the smog, but almost all the time, you step outside and you say, wow. You don't go, wow, this is a medium starry night. You know, I've seen better. You walk outside, you see some stars, you say, wow. And that's the plant, mister. And you kind of wake back up. And then you find out you're damaged, but that's like you're one of the people that you are is damaged. The human person, the person with the biography is damaged. But the eternal person, the soul person, the spirit person can't be damaged because it's just made of energy, and energy can't be damaged, right? It can be transformed. So I think it's partly a way of talking to God differently and then scribbling down actions you can take. Boy, calling somebody for me is the only way I ever let go. People always say, let go, let God. And I was like, oh, I want to just stab you in the middle of your forehead with the pen I stole from you. Because if I could let go, I would. But if I call someone and I talk for 5 minutes and I'm heard, I can let go. It's a miracle every time. Help me live with just what is real right now, that I'm in turmoil, I do need help, I don't know where it'll come from, but just for the hell of it, I'm going to trust that there will be help, there will be buoyancy, there will be fresh air, there will be a solution. There always is. So I hope that's helpful. Here's a person.
What did your liberal, lefty, atheist parents think when you embraced God, and your brother as well?
Well, my father died when I was young, and I like 25. He got sick when I was 23, and I had always just, you know, like everything else, kept everything a secret, because I was raised to be a secret keeper, and that's what I do best, is I also lie, really, left to my own devices. Sometimes I lie to because I'm bored, and I'll lie. But now I usually say, oh, I just lied. I don't know why I even said that. But you were always allowed to be sort of Eastern in your religion, in a spiritual way, because there was Alan Watts, you know, there was Ram Dass, there was all of the Japanese tradition. There was the great Asian tradition of the poets and the Basho and... So it was okay if you went that direction. So I just always kept it a secret, and it didn't really come up with my mom. She had been confirmed Anglican in Liverpool when she was 10, so that would have been 33, 34. And she went to church sometimes on Christmas Eve. Can we do that together? But, you know, you find as you get older, it doesn't make sense to talk to certain people about certain topics because they aren't patient about it. And my mother... I would bring up certain things. My mother would say, oh, for Christ's sake, that's ridiculous, because she was very English. So, you know, that explains that. And my father, in the last year of his life, did want to talk about the spirituality that I had been reading and studying about, very Jewish and very Eastern, more than anything. And and then with my brothers, my older brother had moved away, and I didn't get to see him that much. And my younger brother had been in the army, and he had fallen in with some rogue Catholics. And he was drinking and using, and he had always loved Mary. And I always loved Mary, too, especially during the cocaine and methadrine nights, because I always knew that Mary loved me. I just did. Maybe it was the Beatles song, Let It Be. Maybe it was that Mary was everyone's mother, and every mother loves every one of their children, and they love the most damaged of their children. So he and I always share this relationship with Mary. I have a great Mary joke, by the way, I'll tell you in a second. But and so when I told Steve I was going to this church, he, you know, it didn't bother him. He'd go to the Catholic church. And then I got sober about 6 months ahead of him, and he got sober too. And so he loved Jesus because he'd been in the army and he'd been drinking and using and hanging out with these Catholics. He had a little tiny military missile, and it worked for him fine. But we were the two youngest and the two most overtly damaged of the family. We showed, you know, our wounds showed. And so then when I was baptized, Steve-O thought it was great, my younger brother. And then John was very polite about it all. Because, you know, if you become a person, a sober person, you become a person of radical self-love, you are breaking a family contract that you signed at 4 years old.
Yeah.
That you will not have a big, juicy life. You will not stop the train of achievement and forward thrust. So it's a life-threatening thing to do, to break that contract. And my younger brother and I, every step of the way, we're in on it together. Like, whoa. You know, they'd ask us to keep secrets, and we kept the secret that we were in healing. We had broken the contract, and we didn't know what awaited us. You think as a child, the long, bony finger will come down. You promised not to tell, and it didn't. So then, as I said, my older brother was sort of horrified, and then he became born again, and then I've been able to just mock him ever since. But I'll tell you the Mary joke. I just love it. So Jesus sort of annoyed one day because just so many people are walking around heaven, you know. It's just like not very selective. And and he goes up to St. Peter, who's at the gates, and he said, "What is going on today? This is crazy." And Peter says, "Oh, your mother's in the kitchen. She's opened the window and she's letting everybody in." So that was who I always thought Mary was. But she was in the kitchen and she'd gotten the window up. She was letting everybody in. She's getting him a glass of water and she was hugging him. Every mother loves every one of their children. So other people, I have a lot of friends that the people that are furious that I wrote this book because they feel like I'm capitalizing on something. And you feel like, by a certain age, you don't know how much time you have left. I'm not going to convince anyone of anything. I've never tried to convert a person in my life. I tried to get a lot of people sober when I was newly sober until I figured out that not one single person had gotten one single other person sober in the history of Earth. That what gets you sober is the catastrophe of your own behavior and God as you understand God. So, I have to go to a reading group next week with somebody who just finds it offensive, having loved my father also, that I'm a Christian and I've written this prayer book. And you think, well, whatever. You know, people get to think what they think. If she wants to be, like, in this weird, pissy state, that's fine. She doesn't know how long she's going to live either. And when my best friend was dying and had 2 weeks to live, and I was asking her if she thought I looked heavy in this dress, or if my hips looked heavy, she said, "Annie, you don't have that kind of time." She was 37, and I live by that. So I don't have the kind of time to try to convince Lizzie it's okay for me to be a woman of constant prayer, with no understanding theologically, who feels even I have been invited into the kingdom, which is wherever we are together. So is there a question back there? And then this one here.
I'd like to ask Father Boyle, when and how did you know that your place was in East L.A. and that your work was with gang members long term?
Well, I was assigned there because I had been in Bolivia and it was kind of a conversion time for me. And so then I came back, I got sick, and I asked my provincial to send me to the poorest place, and it was Dolores Mission, which had the highest concentration of gang activity in the city. And
when was that?
1984 was the first time I went there. Mm-hmm. And then in 86 I was pastor, and I haven't left since then, pretty much. So, I don't know. Vocations sort of get you. You don't really locate them. And then I just started burying kids, and that's sort of how things, the scales fell from my eyes. And
you had kids?
No, I started to bury kids in my
community.
Bury them.
Oh. Oh, God. Did you?
I didn't mention that in my book.
Yeah. Yeah. Are they here?
But I won't hesitate to mention it in my second one.
Yeah. Did you always believe in God, and you just how did you come to be a believer and a priest?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I come from a very large Catholic family, so that you know, and there's ruin in there too, you know. But I don't know. You just kind of. I had, for me, it was sort of Jesus, yes, but it's sort of this God who, you things rhyme with God. There is, I read a interview with Mel Brooks the other day, and they ask him, do you kind of agree with this idea that comedians are always compensating for something? He said, no, I'm a comedian because I want to continue something. And then he has this image, if anybody read this, where it says, when I was a little kid and it was a cold winter morning, my mother would take my socks, my underwear, my shirt, and my trousers and put them on the radiator. Oh. Then she would dress me under the covers, kissing me and whistling. And then he said, I'm a comedian because I'm on stage and I want my clothes warm from the radiator and I want my mom whistling. And I thought, I read that and I said, this is our experience, I think, of God, who God is. This mother who insists that your clothes be hot, that you get dressed under the covers, and all she's doing is kissing you and whistling. It doesn't get better than that. I mean, and that sort of, you want to dedicate your life to the integrity of a God who loves you without measure and without regret like that. But there are a billion of images that everybody has that make you want to take seriously what Jesus took seriously. Mm-hmm. Because God was at the center of his life and you kind of mm-hmm. want the same.
Mm-hmm. I try not to hate. Mm-hmm. Not because I'm good, but because it's really toxic to me. But that doesn't include Dick Cheney or John Bonner.
Who, John Bolton?
John. Oh, no,
John
we can
Boehner
add.
And John Bolton. Don't
we
listen.
Can add. Yeah, and Dick Cheney. Bolton. Yeah.
Okay.
So, do you think Jesus wants me to love Dick Cheney and John Bonner?
You know, I don't have a clue what Jesus wants, except that I know how toxic I have gotten. And that was when I wrote Plan B during the 8 years of the Bush administration. And because I felt like I was going under, and I wanted to give people, I wanted to keep people company, and I wanted to help people keep their heads above water. And I had this great Jesuit friend, Tom Weston, and I would call him, because I'd start to go crazy. Like when it turned out we were going to bomb Iraq. And I'd call him, and he'd say, how can God love Dick Cheney as much as he loves my Sunday school kids? And he'd say, that's a mystery of grace. And he'd say, God loves Dick Cheney because God loves, period. And but then he'd always say that, and I'd say, is Dick Cheney going to go to heaven? And he'd say, yes, but he's going to have to sit with the Muslims. And he's going to need to learn to love them. And to see them as his brothers and sisters, equal in the eyes of God. So I get pretty toxic, you know. And then the only thing that helps is laughing about it and telling the truth about it. I have said so many times, laughter really is carbonated holiness. It really is. And when you're in clenched fist and grippage, and you get your sense of humor back about something, it feels to me like a small, like maybe a brown bag miracle every time. It is so transformational to get your sense of humor back. So I have to tell people, I talk to Tom almost every day, and it's usually about who we hate most. And then we break through. But I was thinking of writing a book called All the People I Hate, A Christian Perspective. And this is why I'm glad to have a savior. And when I'm toxic, it's because I'm seeing somebody else as being at fault, less than, or just evil. And but you know, when Dick Cheney got his heart, I struggled. I struggled. And I knew two things. I would wash Dick Cheney's feet, because that is what Jesus would want, and it wouldn't be that big a deal. And I believe Dick Cheney would wash my feet. And I also, about 4 months later, thought, we want that heart back, because it was the heart of a boy. And I thought, I'm not going to understand this side of eternity. So I call Tom, and we just, you know, we say, me too. And we say, it keeps you toxic, keeps you in, you know, they win. And do something, take the action, do something else. You know, let's go shop. Tom and I always go to IKEA, it's sort of our church. And we just look at all the really great napkins and stuff like that. And, then the plates of the earth shift, and you don't care anymore. I don't care about John Bolton right now. During the election, I thought John Bolton's going to be Secretary of State. And I was very scared. All of my hate springs from fear. The truth is that I feel the world was irreparably damaged during those 8 years of Bush Cheney. I do. I feel that my grandchild's future is in very severe jeopardy, having had two Texas oil men at the helm for 8 years. But you know what? It's like, Annie, thanks for sharing. Maybe, maybe not. They thought that in 1900. You know, the people in 1800 thought it. The people thought Lincoln had irreparably destroyed this country. So we don't see very well, and I do believe there's a one-foot border around the movie screen of what we can see. And sometimes the miracle I get is that I lighten up, or I step on the cosmic banana peel, you know, and I end up on my butt and go, oh, help me, I'm so tired of me. You know, one time, I'll get back to you. One time, when Sam was a little boy, I think he was about 5, it was a very, very hot, muggy day in San Francisco, and he got his head caught between the slats of somebody's chair. And I looked away. You know, they would say, oh, you know, they're all kids. God has a special eye out for kids and drunks. And then there's my kid, because I took my eye off, and for 20 seconds, he got his head caught between two slats. And I looked over him, and he said, I need help with me. And I thought it was the single greatest prayer I ever heard. And that's usually where I end up. I need help with me. I'm not in charge of me. I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand God. And I'm not in charge of me. I'm in charge of the dogs and then the new cat.
So we're getting two questions.
Two questions. Okay, great. There's some people in over here.
Either of you, wondering when you have the experience of praying and feeling like you're not being listened to.
You're a priest. We pray. We pay you to have this sort of information.
For me, it's never about listening, somebody listening, mm-hmm. or about God listening. It's about showing up and... I appreciated that you were rehabilitating Mother Teresa in your book.
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was sweet, and yeah. I thought that was actually right. But I also, she changed for me once I, because I had also, you know, I mean, I have great respect for her and everything, but the fact that the consolations of God sort of left her yeah. the minute she became, started to do this work.
Yeah.
And talk about a mystery and sort of wrap your mind around how hard that must have been. So it wasn't like you kind of dedicate yourself to the God of all consolation rather than the consolations of God, mm-hmm. you know, where it's always this payoff and that you feel good. You know, it's sort of like you try to anchor yourself in the truth of what is and who you are and a God who loves you more than you could ask or imagine. So whether, I don't know what listening, I don't ever kind of expect that from God. I don't ask anything, frankly. I just get me through this day and keep me putting first things recognizably first, I think.
And also, people ask me, do you ever lose your faith in God? With what happens in the bigger world and in our little galaxies. And I can honestly answer, I never lose faith. It's partly because I'm a sober alcoholic. And you just don't, you know, you don't because you know where you were. And you can't get to where you are now from where you were unless there has been grace. sufficient to cause a very, very big miracle in a person of no hope and no sense of self left and no sense of dignity left, and to be here is not possible without grace. But I also, right now in my very small world, I see very few people socially. I mostly don't socialize. One of my friends has a 15-year-old with brain cancer, and they're great because they go to church and they're in recovery and they pray every morning. And because their kid was in a coma 18 months ago, he ended up at the same rehab where Gabby Giffords was. And he walked out of there. He walks haltingly. He's not the kid that had the brain bleed. He's not the same kid. Nancy Pelosi walked by Mason's hospital room and blew a kiss to the mother. She said she could never doubt God after that. But I have a friend of our very dear friend whose 3-week-old baby has had 2 heart surgeries already. And the baby is going home next week. Her name is Cora. For the believing people who have lists of people this little one can use a leg up, which prayer is. But these people have kept their faith that their children have been perfectly, amazingly tended to, both by doctors and by God, as they understand God. And, people can say, but you're not really thanking God for Cora's life, are you? You thank the doctors at UC Med. You think Cora's at UC Med. Why would you stop? Figure it out is not a good slogan. Cora's coming home. And if Cora becomes very sick, the mother knows that there will be grace sufficient one day at a time for them to survive the loss of their child. Because you know that by a certain age, you see it. It can't happen. I don't see how that could happen. But I've seen it more times than I could even tell you. And I see people who have lives of elegance and quiet dignity and endless grief, who are still laughing and they're not drinking and they're getting thirsty people water. So I don't know. I'm in the face of that, I don't ever lose my faith. I think more and more this world is so difficult. It blows my mind. And when I do see God face to face, I am going to say to her, what on earth were you thinking? So one more question.
One last one.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Ryan. I'm a pastor, and I have a pastor friend of mine who says that preaching is basically opening a vein and sort of bleeding in front of everybody. And so I just want to thank you for sort of being willing to do that on paper for all of us. My question is, when I read your writing, and I love the way you write, what strikes me is the power of observation that you have and the way that you just see things that I wish I could see. I've been reading David Yulin a bit lately too, and it seems like he does that, and so many good writers.
You're reading who?
David Yulin.
Oh, yeah.
And so is there any advice you would give for those of us here that are writers or would like to be better writers, how you see things that other people don't see, or you see the humor in things that just pass by other people?
Well, I think, did you not grow up around alcoholism? So you did not grow up in an alcoholic family, right?
Yeah, this is what Chimamanda Adichie said. Like, she felt like reading, growing up as a writer, she had to have this miserable family in order to be a good writer. And she said, my family was pretty good.
I don't think you need to be have a miserable family to be a writer, although most of the people I know had very scary, very lonely, isolated, sometimes in huge family childhoods. But people who grew around alcoholism, I have experienced, and myself, pay very good attention. I pay too much. I have a disease of attention, of attention paying. And I had to survive. And but there's lots and lots of times where we're just made numb by the world. We're made numb and we're made half dead. And we're so often we're multitasking. We're doing so many different things at once. We're busy. And we think, we have all the time in the world. You got to ask yourself say to yourself every day, I don't, you don't have that kind of time. You don't, it's today or not at all. Today is the eternal present. It's the day that links us with all eternity and with the afterlife. And it's now. And so you get a rubber band and you start gently snapping the rubber band. You find other people who are writing. You read a lot more poetry. You read a lot more poetry. Poets are the teachers of presence, of paying attention. And if you read a poem, even a short poem every day, it retrains you. Because that's what they're doing, is paying attention. I mean, there's some great poets in this room. And what you do is you pay attention, and it doesn't come through you. It's not like, you know, it's like Kevin Bellows does not run to her desk and scribble down this poem as it came, as through dictation, through her. She knows, and I know, that we're doing the same thing, and that a little bit of it, you see a little bit, and it moves you. It, like, tugs on your sleeves, right? Something sort of tugs on your sleeves, and you go, wow, that was sort of a trip. A normal person might see a little gray bird and go, that's just a little gray bird. There's no such thing as just a little gray bird. Most of them are just little gray birds. We're all little gray birds. None of us here will be remembered. We're little gray birds. My little grandson and I will see a little gray bird and we'll go, whoa. There was a pastor in the South last week who thought my book was called, we did an interview, he thought my book was Help, Thanks, Whoa. And I love that because it's actually a better title. But a poet, a working poet, which is to say, it's not ethereal, it's not about inspiration. Inspiration is another way to get out of doing that day's work. You're going to be a working poet, a working writer. You get your butt in the chair and you find a way, bribes and threats, to keep your butt in the chair, and you write badly. Kevin sits down and she writes terribly long and over-detailed drafts. I sit down. I have drafts on my desk right now. If you looked at them, you go, huh, that's funny. This is not really, it's going to be twice again as long as it needs to be. Sorry, and too many details. It's going to be slightly overwritten, and it may be a little sentimental. And then you push back your sleeves, and you make it better. And then you make it better, and then you show it to someone, and they go, oh, I get it. You must have gotten that little tug on your sleeve when you saw that little gray bird doing that with your grandson. And you go, yeah, I did. And they go, well, you know what? I love it. The whole first page you could lose. You know, and you have to be able to trust other people because they're going to save you from yourself, from putting bad work out there. I have one of my very best friends reads my work, and he says, I'm going to love this. And I don't. Yeah. And I give it to him to save me from putting it out there into the public and it not being good enough yet. It's like a Polaroid, like life is. It reveals a little bit of itself and it reveals a little bit more. And sometimes we're so impatient, we wave the Polaroid. I don't even know if they still make them, but I have a Polaroid and I buy film on eBay. And it reveals itself. I thought I was taking a picture of you and your blouse. But I didn't even notice that there was a flower beside you or that two rows back, this other, you know, and little by little, the Polaroid reveals a lot of life being lived, a lot of faces with a lot of pain, a lot of joy, a lot of peace, a lot of confusion. That's the human condition. And that's what you do is you keep a little rubber band, you find a friend you can trust to tell you the truth, and you read a lot more poetry. And I'll just close, let's close with this to me is almost like a prayer. It's that those great sentence, one sentence of the great novelist E.L. Doctorow, who said that writing is like driving at night with the headlights on. It's two sentences. You can only see a little ways in front of you, but you can make the whole journey that way, right? And that's Homeboy Industries. Yeah. You saw a little bit of light. You stepped into it. You followed it. I would love to see where it all leads. And how it all turns out.
That's all you can
do.
But
it's driving at night with the headlights on. You can only see a little ways in front of you, and you can make the whole journey that way. If you have like two beautiful friends. If you have two beautiful friends and you love to read, this is what I tell young people when I speak to them. What do you love to do? I love to dance. One of them said the other day, I love to dance. It's very chubby African-American day. Boy on the East Coast. What do you love? He said, I love to dance. He also loved to read. I said, if you dance and you read and you have two beautiful friends, you're going to have a great life. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.